Doon, 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 doon. There we go.
Does that mean it's going to explode now?
Well, in 5 seconds. Welcome again. I'm going to do the same thing so we have a recording of that. My name is Robbie Harris. I'm chair of the Bible department here, pinch hitting for Professor David Kramer, who is our librarian. And I want to welcome you to a library book talk. Now, you might be surprised that the library book talk is not in the library, although this is technically still in the library building. Because if you were to walk upstairs and look through the windows, you would see that the seminary is in a period of about to be major renovation, where we are going to create, instead of having the library for the 20th century, we will have, please God, in a number of years, the library for the 21st century. If it takes too longer, we're going to be calling it the library for the 22nd century, but I don't think it should take that long. But in any case, we want to say Bruchim Habaim and welcome to JTS. In a minute, I'm going to formally introduce our speaker, but I would like to say that our talk will be, approximately a half hour to 40 minutes. You'll have an opportunity to ask questions at the very end. And lucky for you, our speaker's book will be available for sale on that bookshelf for $40 at the end of the talk. One last bit of business before I turn to Professor Joseph is next week, Tuesday, October 20th, Yair Lorberberm will do the next library book talk on the subject Myth, Theology, and Law in Modern Judaism. So not to be missed. In any case, I'm so very happy to welcome Professor Dr. Alice Joseph. Now, a moment ago, one of our guests said to Allison, "Well, you know, you have three children. My gosh! Just a while ago, you were a student, or whatever you said." And I went, "Yes, that's right, because she was a student here at Barnard and the Jewish Theological Seminary's double degree program. So you too could grow up to be a PhD in Bible. At any rate." We're so very happy to welcome you back, which is always your home, Allison. Allison has a really, really interesting, things that I did not know about her, five-page CV. Were I to read even the highlights alone from these five pages, that would be the entirety of our time tonight. So instead of that, I will mention just a couple things, that Dr. Joseph got her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, in Bible and Near Eastern Studies, and also took degrees from Emory, JTS, and as I mentioned, Barnard College. Tonight, she's going to paint us a portrait of the kings. And I'm going to turn it over to you. If you want to stand or you want to sit, but if you want to stand, I'm going to put that over there
okay. Next
to you.
I will
Great. Try
not to knock it off.
We'll give a warm seminary round.
Thank you, and thank you, Robbie. What a thrill it is, really, to be here tonight, to return to the institution that in many ways gave me my professional start. I don't think I could have imagined as an undergraduate Bible major at List College that one day I would be up here talking about a book I had written. Seeing so many friends, teachers, and mentors in the audience. Wow. It is always a pleasure to come home again. My studies took me, as Robbie said, from New York to the South, to Emory University, and then to the West Coast, to the University of California at Berkeley. At Berkeley, I studied with Ron Hendel and Robert Alter, also a JTS alum. This unique combination of Hendel, representative of the traditional group of scholars coming out of Harvard, under the tutelage of the well-known Frank Moore Cross, interested in dating and composition of the biblical text, and Alter's literary approach to reading biblical texts is wholly apparent in my work. It's funny. I worked on this book for many years, first as my dissertation and later in revision for the book you can see today. And it was only after it was published and I started talking to people about it that I realized what the book was really about. I was interested in the fusion of history, the historical context, and the writing of history with the literary artistry of the biblical writer. Once we were able to identify the place and time of composition, could we say anything about why or how it got written? This led me to the Book of Kings. The Book of Kings has a unique compositional history. While debated exactly when to date it, scholars agree that the majority of the book was written at one time. So it doesn't have the fragmentary compositional issues that we find when we study the Torah. So all the while, for about 7 years, I thought I was writing the book about the Book of Kings and about the kings and kings. I was partial specifically to the kings Jeroboam and Josiah. Jeroboam, the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel, is the villain of the Book of Kings. His religious sites set up in Dan and Bethel, the northernmost and southernmost parts of his kingdom, were attacked as foreign and idolatrous. The appeal of Jeroboam for me is that he gets a bad rap and falls victim to the old saying, history is written by the victors. And the victors, those royal scribes of 7th century Jerusalem, are wholly opposed to these shrines established outside Jerusalem. The second figure was the great King Josiah, the religious reformer who transformed worship in Israel, closing worship sites outside of Jerusalem. He is the king employing those royal scribes who brought us the Book of Kings. With these two kings in mind, the hero and the villain, I wrote my book. It was only after its publication, when I started to speaking to people, I realized this book is really about David. What a surprise. I guess the publisher knew better because they put him on the cover. David, the warrior king who fills the lines of the Book of Samuel and dies in the first two chapters of Kings, was my subject. I really was surprised. The David of legend is many things. He is a great warrior. Only a boy, he defeats the mythic giant Goliath. He is praised. Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands. He is a musician, able to soothe the soul of King Saul, and as our tradition states, the composer of the Psalms. He returns the Ark to Jerusalem, singing and dancing in praise of God. He is a womanizer and a murderer. Not only does he sleep with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, but when he finds out that she is pregnant, he tries to pass off the child as Uriah's. David attempts to bring Uriah back from battle to sleep with his wife, so he will think he is the rightful father to David's child. When this doesn't work, he has Uriah killed. He is a usurper king, seizing the throne granted with God and the prophet's authority from Saul and his son Jonathan. He is a brilliant political strategist akin to Shakespeare's Hamlet and Machiavelli. The legacy of King David is certainly mixed. He is a great king known for expanding the empire and leading his people to defeat the Philistines. He is loved by Jonathan and Michal, the people, and by God. He charges his son Solomon to off his enemies. His sons battle for succession, killing each other in the process. It is noteworthy that biblical scholar Baruch Halpern subtitles his 2001 book on David, Messiah, Murderer, Traitor, King. You don't get more conflicted than that. The figure of David has inspired scholars, rabbis, and novelists. In only the past decade, the number of books on David is mind-boggling, including the recent volume by Rabbi David Wolpe, David, the Divided Heart, for which he has also sold the movie rights. So everyone is fascinated by David, even Hollywood. Still, I didn't know that I was contributing to the mix. But I've come to realize that this book is about David, perhaps in absentia. This is not the David of Samuel, but a literary reimagining of the figure of David. In the Book of Kings, David becomes the model for all the kings. Given my introduction to David, he doesn't seem like the most likely candidate. Yet the more than 40 monarchs who rule Israel and Judah from the 10th to 6th century BCE are compared to David. Most kings do what is evil in the eyes of Yahweh. Some do what is right in the eyes of Yahweh, and even fewer, 3 to be exact, are like David. What does it mean to be like David? It might make for an interesting soap opera, but likely the handbook on how to be a good king is not. How to commit adultery, cuckold the husband, and have him killed without getting caught. Instead, the Book of Kings begins differently. With his dying breaths, David instructs his son and successor Solomon what to do. In 1 Kings 2, 3 to 4, and this is the first text on the handout, Before instructing Solomon to do away with all his enemies, David orders Solomon to keep the covenant in order to ensure that the promise God made to David of an eternal dynasty will be fulfilled. David says, Vishmartem et mishmeret Adonai Elohecha, lelechet bedrachav lishmor chukotav, mitzvotav, umishpotav, ve'irotav, kakatuv betorat Moshe, laman taskil et kol asher ta'aseh, ve'et kol asher tifnehem, laman yakim Adonai et dvarav, asher diber elai lemor. Im yishmeru banecha et darkam, lalechet lefanai, be'emet bechol levavchem, ubechol nafsham, le'mor lo yikaret lecha, ish me'al kisei Yisrael. Keep the mandates of Yahweh your God, following his ways, keeping his statutes and commandments, laws and warnings, as it is written in the instruction of Moses, so that you will be successful in whatever you do and to whatever you turn. In order that Yahweh will fulfill his word, which he spoke to me, saying, if your sons are careful in their way to walk before me faithfully, with all their heart and with all their soul, no one will be cut off from the throne of Israel. Verse 3 describes the condition for success as linked to careful observance of Yahweh's laws, stipulated in the multiple terms of chukim, mitzvot, mishpatim, and edot. These words are repeated often throughout Kings. Verse 4 highlights the conditions for an eternal Davidic kingship as dependent on the faithfulness of David's sons in directing of their bechol levav uvechol nefesh, which requires the application of the heart and soul as the way to observe the commandments and demonstrate loyalty. These instructions to Solomon in the early chapters of the book of Kings lay out not only what it means to be a good king, a king like David, but represent what is important to the authors of the book. As I previously mentioned, the first edition of the Book of Kings emerges from the 7th century court of Josiah. Josiah embarks on a major religious reform, closing down any cult sites competing with Jerusalem. As the story goes in 2 Kings 22, Josiah is inspired by the finding of a scroll during temple renovations. It's just too convenient that they find this. He rends his clothes and begs forgiveness from God because the people have been non-compliant with the stipulations prescribed by the scroll. The majority of scholars have equated this found scroll with an early version of Deuteronomy because of correspondence between Josiah's reform and the laws of Deuteronomy. David's instructions for faithfulness, Bechol levav uvechol nefesh, sounds like the Shema, right? In Deuteronomy 5. The book of Deuteronomy stipulates a specific theology unique from other biblical law codes found in Exodus and Leviticus. This theology is focused on centralization of the cult in Jerusalem, fidelity to the covenant, the eternity of the Davidic dynasty, and Jerusalem as the chosen city. Since the work of Benedict Spinoza in the late 17th century, Bible critics have discussed the connection between the book of Deuteronomy and the historical books of the former prophets. The history of Israel following the Torah, chronicling the conquest of the land to the period of the Judges, the inception and fall of monarchy until the Babylonian exile, found in the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, is influenced by the theology of Deuteronomy. It is for this reason that scholars regularly refer to these books as the Deuteronomistic history. The articulation of the theology is particularly strong in the Book of Kings, where the evaluations of the kings and the portrait of David are tied to correspondences with Deuteronomistic theology. We call the author of this history the Deuteronomistic historian or the Deuteronomist. It may be surprising to learn that centralization of worship in Jerusalem and the removal of traditional and syncretistic cult symbols were a major break with Israelite religion, an innovation, and required positive promotion by the Deuteronomistic historian. In writing his history of the monarchy, the Deuteronomist is focused on using his history as a didactic tool to teach proper worship and the necessity of compliance to the covenant. This is the single most important goal of the Deuteronomistic history, Worship is only permitted in the temple in Jerusalem. Previously accepted cult sites and iconography, such as Jeroboam's calves, Asherim and Matzevot, the pillars and sacred poles, are all prohibited. In order to clearly identify these practices as forbidden, the Deuteronomist adopts a rhetoric of idolatry in which these previously acceptable Yahwistic and traditional practices are presented as foreign and idolatrous. It is through this ideological lens that the Deuteronomist presents the events that take place in the history of Israel and the actors in this history. Those kings who keep the covenant are good and are theoretically rewarded with peaceful and prosperous reigns, and those who do not are punished. This is also true for the collectivity of the people. The northern kingdom of Israel sinned by following the uncentralized cult of Jeroboam, so they were destroyed and exiled. By evaluating what happens to the players of history through the lens of Deuteronomistic theology, the Deuteronomist attempts to make sense of history, particularly the bad things that have befallen Israel and Judah, and to inspire his audience to fidelity to that same theology. The Deuteronomist wants us to believe that if only the historical characters were faithful to the Deuteronomistic covenant, their fates would have turned out differently. Likewise, the people of Judah should now get on board in the hopes that their future will end better than Israel's. So where does David fit in? Despite all those things, positive and negative, that we know about David from his own story in Samuel, warrior, traitor, womanizer, murderer, the Deuteronomist reimagines the figure of David and creates a literary portrait that serves as the model for all the kings. He uses David as a royal prototype. In my book, I deem this the Davidic prototype strategy. What I mean by this is that the Deuteronomist constructs a typology in which all kings are fit into a specific model. It is first necessary to consider what a literary prototype is and how it functions in our historical narratives. Cognitive linguist George Lakoff defines prototypes as cognitive reference points of various sorts that form the basis for inferences. These inferences are part of the conceptual structure in which prototypes have a special cognitive status of being a best example. The use of a royal prototype strategy is one of the major organizing structures employed throughout kings. The Deuteronomist focuses on the royal portrait as a literary vehicle to convey his theological program. He categorizes the kings into two groups, those who do what is right, and those who do what is evil in the eyes of Yahweh. Among the totality of kings, the Deuteronomist highlights a few specific kings to make clear what behavior is to be tolerated and praised. These kings get longer treatment in the narrative. Instead of being portrayed as a real person, each of these kings is evaluated through the lens of the prototype to assess his fidelity to the covenant and his love of Yahweh. While my argument for the use of the prototype strategy builds on the ideas of others, including renowned scholar Gerhard von Rath, followed by Richard Nelson, it takes into account further literary considerations. And this is the influence of my education and working with Robert Alter. In Kings, prototypes of individual kings, David as the model for the good king and an anti-David for the bad king, are laid out, allowing the reader to consider each king and his individual acts on micro and macro levels. What did this king do? How does his character and reign fit into the larger history of Israel and Judah and reflect the way Yahweh works in history? Furthermore, the use of a prototype allows the reader to infer information about each king without the narrator supplying it, because he is cast in a mold that the audience already recognizes. David in Kings is the model of the Deuteronomistically adherent king. With this in mind, we return to David's instructions to Solomon in 1 Kings 2, 3-4. And so that's the same first text, which on the handout, instead of that other manual description I gave a new description. I lost my handout in the pile. How to be a king by me, your father David. So again, we see this text. Keep the mandates of Yahweh your God, following his ways, keeping his statutes and commandments, laws and warnings, as is written in the instruction of Moses, so that you will be successful in whatever you do and to whatever you turn. While he doesn't explicitly say, just as I did, we presume that the David portrayed in this passage behaved this way. The portrait of David that begins to be depicted here is entirely different from that of the book of Samuel. In his initial actions, Solomon follows the statutes of his father David. At Gibeon, Solomon appeals to the image of David as Yahweh's servant, and Solomon said to Yahweh, "You showed great favor for your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness and righteousness, and the integrity of his heart was with you." After building and dedication of the temple, Solomon is reminded what it means to be wholeheartedly with God. God reaffirms and elaborates on the promise, further articulating how David behaved and what Solomon will receive if he emulates David. This is the text at the bottom of the first side. "And if you walk before me as David, your father walked with a blameless heart and righteousness, doing all that I commanded you, my laws and statutes you will observe, and I will establish the throne of your kingship over Israel forever, as I spoke to David your father, saying, there will be not a man of yours cut off from the throne of Israel," in 1 Kings 9, 4-5. You would think that with such explicit direction from both his father David and from God, and with so great a reward as an eternal dynasty, that Solomon would know what to do. But as we know, Solomon is punished at the end of his reign, and the unified Davidic kingdom is divided after his death, the major part of which is torn from the control of his son. The portrait of David as the prototype of the good king is first developed as bookends to the Solomon story. First, David is the exemplar for Solomon, and then at the end of his reign, the standard against which Solomon does not measure. Solomon, given specific instructions of how to be a good king, helps us define what that role means. Solomon functions proleptically for all the kings, good and bad. Through the portrait of Solomon, the prototype of the comparative David is constructed. The concept of a good king, one who is faithful to the covenant, is first established here in 1 Kings 2, in David's charge to Solomon. Prosperity and dynastic continuity rely on the king following the laws and commandments, statutes and testimonies of the law of Moses. Both the potential buildup of how Solomon should be and the rebuke for the reality of his actions highlight what it means to be like David. Solomon does great things throughout his reign, like building the temple, and is known for his great wisdom. But the text reports that at the end of his life he strays from Yahweh. His 1,000 wives include many foreign women who turn his heart towards their gods. 1 Kings 11:4 reports that it happened in Solomon's old age that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully with Yahweh his God, as was the heart of David his father. The description of Solomon's apostasy further in this chapter in verses 9 to 11 is couched in Deuteronomistic language. The kingdom will be torn away from Solomon because he did not keep Yahweh's covenant and laws. The rebuke reflects the language of the charge. While Solomon was primed to be like David, he is unsuccessful. Solomon's heart was not fully with Yahweh as David's was, and he is punished. Jeroboam is given the lion's share of the kingdom, 10 tribes, and he becomes the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel. Jeroboam is introduced as a second David, the first king presented to match the wholehearted devotion of the Deuteronomist literary David. Jeroboam is constructed using the Davidic prototype strategy, but he is unable to live up to the literary expectations. So not only does Jeroboam come to embody the evil king, the standard against which each subsequent bad king of Israel is measured, but he also, his blatant disregard for his literary potential ultimately leads to his own demise and that of his house and the entirety of his kingdom. The building of the Davidic potential only further emphasizes the depth to which Jeroboam will fail. This portrait is possible because of the use of the prototype strategy. Employing Jeroboam as the prototype of the evil king, as opposed to Ahab, who is known as the most evil king, highlights one of the major foci of the Deuteronomist, railing against the system of decentralized worship. Jeroboam is presented as a vehicle for the punishment of Solomon and a potential David. The prophet Ahijah tells Jeroboam, because he, meaning Solomon, left me, and he bowed to Astarte, god of the Sidonians, to Chemosh, the god of Moab, and to Milcom, god of the Ammonites, and he did not walk in my way, to do right in my eyes, and to keep my laws and ordinances as David his father. I will take the kingdom from his son and give it to you, the 10 tribes. And then the instruction to Jeroboam. Thus it will be if you heed all that I will command you, and you will walk in my way and do what is right in my eyes, to keep my law and commandments, which David my servant did. Then I will be with you, and I will build for you a lasting dynasty, as I built for David, and I will give to you Israel. So it's very clear what the kings are supposed to do. The investiture presents Jeroboam in the model of David, Yahweh's and the Deuteronomist's beloved king. The denunciation of Jeroboam becomes even more formidable when he is rejected for not being David-like. It seems clear what he must do. The instruction in 1 Kings 11:38 echoes the words spoken to Solomon by David in 1 Kings 2, 3, and 4, and Yahweh's words of punishment to Solomon in 1 Kings 11:11 to 13. In Deuteronomistic style, the historian repeats almost verbatim the conditions of the division of the kingdom, just as Yahweh speaks to Solomon. While not quite as verbose as David's words to Solomon, Ahijah's injunction to Jeroboam demonstrates similar sentiments. Ahijah charges him to do what is right in the eyes of Yahweh by following Yahweh's way, obeying his commandments and laws. These terms, halach baderech, Asaha Yashar, Chukot, Mitzvot, Mishpatim, Eidot, function as leitvorter in Kings, intentionally repeated words that emphasize their meaning. The comparison to David is made explicit. Do these things, just as David my servant did. Being like David will merit Jeroboam David's reward. Yahweh will be with him and will build him a lasting dynasty. In both the punishment of Solomon and in the installation of Jeroboam, the text focuses on the importance of fidelity to the Deuteronomistic theology. Despite building the temple and the promise to David, Solomon is unable to hold on to the entire kingdom because of his gross violation of the covenant. Jeroboam, by no merit of his own, is the vehicle for that punishment. He is explicitly set up as king because Solomon did not follow Yahweh's commands and statutes. The similar language used in these speeches intrinsically connects Jeroboam's reward with Solomon's punishment, creating a literary portraiture of David, Solomon, and now Jeroboam. While Ahijah's first oracle sets Jeroboam up as a second David, the second oracle in 1 Kings 14 pronounces his doom. After fortifying his hold on the territory, Jeroboam attempts to shore up the loyalty of his people by establishing worship sites within the boundaries of his kingdom so that the people of Israel do not need to return to Jerusalem. He reasonably wonders, how long will Israel remain distinct if it continues to worship in the Jerusalem temple? These shrines at Dan and Bethel were established as Yahwistic, not idolatrous, but present an affront to the Deuteronomistic sensibilities and are therefore deemed idolatrous. The condemnation of Jeroboam by Ahijah is the final episode in the Jeroboam saga. Ahijah's second oracle in 1 Kings 14:7-16 is spoken at Yahweh's behest to Jeroboam's wife. Jeroboam sends his disguised wife to inquire about Jeroboam's sixth son. Yahweh alerts Ahijah that she is coming, and he recognizes her based on Yahweh's tip-off, despite the fact that his eyes had grown dim with old age. Although he is blind, he has the ability to see what Jeroboam and Israel cannot, the sinful nature of Jeroboam's cult. The initial charge against Jeroboam is a reprise of the injunction to Jeroboam and Solomon. You have not been like my servant David, who observed my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only what is right in my eyes. Jeroboam does not do what is right. His heart is not with Yahweh, and he is not like David. Because of this, he will be punished. If David is the prototype, Jeroboam becomes the antitype. The primary claim against Jeroboam is that he is not like David. The sins of his cult are only the how he is not like David. He is set up with the opportunity and constructed according to the literary prototype, but he does not live up to the expectations. Instead of being like the paradigm of the good king, he becomes the prototype of the bad king. He has done worse than all who came before him in 1 Kings 14:9. The Deuteronomist further qualifies what Jeroboam has done. You have gone and made yourself other gods and molten images to anger me, and me you cast off behind your back. Jeroboam has not been faithful to the Deuteronomistic covenant. The house of Jeroboam will be destroyed, and Israel will be exiled. Yahweh will scatter them across the river because they made Asherim, angering Yahweh, and he will give over Israel because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he committed because he caused Israel to sin. This final line of Ahijah's oracle becomes the common refrain of the fate of Israel. Jeroboam inhabits the prototype of the evil king, the standard of the evil king against which the remainder of the kings of Israel will be measured. Still, this portrait is only possible because it is the negation of the Davidic prototype. He is the cause of the sins of the entire kingdom of Israel. These two elements, being like Jeroboam and having caused Israel to sin, are the constituent elements of the judgments of the kings of Israel. So we see that David in Kings was not like David in Samuel, but instead is a literary construct. Solomon is set up to be the next David. Through the instructions to Solomon, we begin to understand what it means to be like David. This prepares us as readers for the arrival of Jeroboam. He is initially introduced as a second David, tapped by the prophet, a founder of a dynasty, something of a usurper king. He is given specific instructions of how to be like David, that he is the beneficiary of Solomon having not been like David, but he is unable to achieve it. Instead, he becomes the anti-David. So if David's not like David, and Solomon and Jeroboam are not like David, who is like David? Towards the end of the history of the monarchy, we meet King Josiah, who is the real David. The literary David constructed in the Davidic prototype strategy is reflective of the portrait of Josiah. David is bolstered as the model of the best kings, better than he appears in his own story in Samuel. And only Josiah can achieve his likeness or even surpass David, loving Yahweh with all his heart, soul, and might, while David only loves Yahweh with his heart. The way the typology is applied to Josiah is unlike any other instance in the history. The Deuteronomist's insistence that Josiah is the paradigm of the good king is overly emphatic. Like the other good kings, he does what is right in Yahweh's eyes. As are two others, he is like David, but he is the only king to comply with the law of the king in Deuteronomy 17. As a type, he is pitted against and triumphs over Solomon and Jeroboam. He undoes both of their sins with his reform. He does better than any of the previous reforming kings, including Asa, Jehoshaphat, and even Hezekiah. And he celebrates the Passover in a way it has never been celebrated by any king. The Davidic prototype is modeled on the character of Josiah rather than the loosely historical David we know from Samuel. There is no other king who can measure up to the paradigm of Josiah. In the Deuteronomist's unparalleled acclaim, Josiah out-Davids even David. The figure of Josiah bears a heavy literary burden. He is the second David and the anti-Jeroboam and the anti-Solomon, the antithesis of the Davidic antitype. Josiah is explicitly set up as an adherent to the Deuteronomic law. The phrase, to walk in the ways of Yahweh, is used throughout Deuteronomy. It is an expression of covenantal loyalty. As previously discussed, the instruction first appears in Kings and David's deathbed directives to Solomon. We keep returning to this text because it guides the way that we think kings should behave. Being like David and following David's way is following the way of Yahweh, as in 1 Kings 2:4. By connecting Josiah with David using these words as opposed to the other Davidic comparisons, the Deuteronomist intrinsically links Josiah and his actions with the stipulations of Deuteronomic law and following the ways of Yahweh, while simultaneously contrasting Josiah with Jeroboam and those kings who continued Jeroboam's sin. In another evaluative comment towards the end of 2 Kings 23, the Deuteronomist remarks that there was no king before Josiah who turned back to Yahweh with all his heart and all his soul and all his might. Again, echoing the words of the Shema, and all the instruction of Moses, Torah Moshe. Josiah's fidelity to the law connects him with Moses and Mosaic law. Establishing Josiah's superiority over the other kings is done primarily through the details of his reform. Josiah's reform is unparalleled in its extent in correspondence with Deuteronomic law. It focuses on Deuteronomistic principles, fidelity to the law, disavowing other gods, and first and foremost, centralization of the cult to the temple in Jerusalem. Josiah ensures the other sites, both Yahwistic and idolatrous, will be permanently out of commission. He sets about cleaning up not only Judah, but also the defunct kingdom of Israel, removing all aspects of idolatry and all non-centralized shrines, and undoing the sins of previous kings. He hits the cult of Jeroboam hard, destroying the altar at Bethel and burning human bones on it. He defiles and completely destroys the locations and accoutrements of these cults, preempting any resurrections of idolatrous and/or non-centralized cults. The use of the Davidic prototype strategy in the Josiah narrative allows the Deuteronomist to present his ultimate king, the reformer who outreforms others, the only king to read the Torah, the king who surpasses even the literary construct on which he is modeled, while focusing on the importance of the Deuteronomistic law code, meaning the found scroll, the implementation of centralization, and the purge of syncretistic cultic elements. The prototype strategy grants the Deuteronomist the ability to activate the typology with a few concise clues, and Josiah is immediately situated among and evaluated against the kings of Israel and Judah. As readers, we know exactly what to expect of a king who is like David, the Deuteronomistically adherent, and not like Jeroboam. This strategy frees up the historian to use his narrative and of the narrative of Josiah and his great reign to focus on programmatic purposes. The events of the reform that put Deuteronomistic law into application remain the main character of the narrative. The Davidic prototype is a literary strategy that the Deuteronomist uses throughout the history. It not only evaluates the individual kings, the good ones like David and the bad ones like the anti-David Jeroboam, but it also provides an overall framework in which to portray and view the literary figures of the individual kings. The kings cast in the model of the prototype signify much more than themselves as individuals. They are the means for constructing the history in general. Israel falls because of the acts of Jeroboam. Josiah attempts to rescue Judah from the same fate. Each king of both Israel and Judah is evaluated in the same way, and the portrait of the Deuteronomist's important kings is constructed similarly, allowing for easy and clear comparisons and contrasts. So why should we care about this Davidic prototype strategy? It gives us a glimpse into the inner workings of the literary style and the programmatic goals of the Deuteronomistic historian. Through the prototype strategy, we see an intentional plan that is used throughout this Josianic edition of the history, from the portrayal of Solomon in the 10th century BCE to Josiah in the late 7th century. The kings who are most interesting to the historian are constructed using the same prototype. This allows us to both compare them and to know what to expect with each subsequent king. The prototype strategy links the characters as types and antitypes, demonstrating the overall intentional literary plan and highlighting the kind of story that he wants to tell. The commonalities between these kings also highlight what issues are most central to the historian, namely centralization and the eradication of synchronized cults. Also, through constructing the kings in the model of the prototype, we can see that the historian is focused on writing a theologically based history. First, the characters of history, The real kings of Israel and Judah are represented as literary figures. Through telling their story, the historian attributes historical and political events to theological causes, demonstrating that everything that happens is a result of God working in history and is reflective of human fidelity to the Deuteronomistic covenant. Individuals, kingdoms, and nations are punished when they violate the tenets of the Deuteronomistic theology. The focus on the royal portrait is a literary vehicle to convey his theological program. The Deuteronomist can categorize the kings into two groups, those who do what is right and those who do what is evil in the eyes of Yahweh, highlighting a few specific kings to make clear what behavior is to be tolerated and praised in his kings. While the history of the monarchy spans half a millennium, only those kings who contribute to the Deuteronomist meta-narrative are constructed using this prototype. The other kings are literal placeholders, filling in historical time between literary import. It is in the portrait of the kings the Deuteronomist highlights that we can most clearly see what he wants to accomplish and how he operates. So, is the book about David? Perhaps, I still don't know, but maybe. But at least I can say that the legacy of the portrait of David is seen in every king. Thank you.
Wow. I'd love to host questions. I also should have said at the beginning that the reason that I'm pinch hitting is that Professor Kramer is out on the coast at a family event. He didn't just casually exit. You should think of him, God forbid. Questions for our speaker?
So who was the Deuteronomist historian?
I think that he was probably a bunch of people. Like a scribal school hanging out in the court of Josiah. I think that the major part of the history points to Josiah's reign as sort of the climax of the history of the kings. When the king is your patron, it's good to say good things about him.
That's a variation of it's good to be the king. It's good to be close to the king.
Right. And I think that it's very focused on Jerusalem, maintaining the power of the monarchy and the cult in Jerusalem. And I think that a lot of the history is too optimistic to be dated into the exile, which is sort of the opposing opinion of scholars, that the majority of the history was written after the exile. I just think that there's too much didactic focus, and that it makes Josiah's reform seem so ridiculous if they're writing the story of this great reform, but Judah has already been destroyed. So I think the reform is sort of like this last-ditch effort. Like, we saw what happened to Israel, so let's get it together and try really hard. The reform doesn't stick.
How does the Deuteronomist resolve David's many flaws with being a model?
So in the Book of Kings, he doesn't really address them. The compositional history of Samuel is interesting because the voice of the Deuteronomist is sort of few and far between. That Samuel is probably made up of some earlier stories that are then collected and woven together by the Deuteronomist. So they keep them in there. I think that was likely because people knew them. If you want people to pay attention to your history and think that you are writing an accurate history, you can't leave out things that people know about, even if they weren't true. Like, you know, every five-year-old knows a story about David and he kills the Goliath. If you were to leave that out because you don't really think of it historically accurate, people would look at your history and say, what kind of history is this? He doesn't even know the most famous story about David. So I don't think that he deals with it. But when you look in Chronicles, which is our second version, a later post-exilic history that retells the stories of Samuel and Kings, David looks a lot better than he did in Samuel. So I think that it's sort of, it may be mediated through the portrait of David and Kings, that the legacy of David as the inherent sort of influences the chronicler to rewrite David's story, cleaning it up, or it just might be that the needs of the people that those scribes are writing for were different, and they didn't want sort of all these mixed stories about David.
Well, the usual view, and I studied this many years ago, was that there were records at the time, not with Samuel, not with David, or with Solomon, but with the kings that followed. And of course, I think that is a very plausible case that somebody came along and gave, like Shakespeare gave form to Tudor dynastic history, gave that form. Very, very fascinating. And I can see that that's rough at all. I mean, the literary ending. But it raises an interesting question. If the book of the five books of Moses was already around, you would think that that would have been a prototype that would have been followed, would have been influenced. And even within the Bible, the story of Jacob, which occupies, would you believe that maybe those stories came later? Maybe the Bible itself came later and chose not to follow that particular prototype in favor of a more, shall we say, commonwealth view. Moses is not a king, and they don't
right.
try to present him as a king. And David is just like, you know, a farmer or whatever, a businessman. It would seem to suggest what I believe, that comes much later. And we do know that Genesis was much, much later than all that.
Let's have Professor Joseph respond.
Okay. So I think that all, even though this is one of the values and detriments of canon, right? We have the Torah is in the beginning, and that's where you read it, and it tells the story of the beginning, right? All the way from the beginning of the world. So we sort of think of that as, in our literary narrative chronology, as first. But when we look at the historical context and where the literature is coming from, it doesn't really happen that way. Like, much of the Torah was probably written during this period of the monarchy. A lot of it could be reflective, these same guys or the same historical context that are putting together these Deuteronomistic books are also thinking about. And we see within the stories, how come Judah is raised above his brothers? Well, Judah is the eponymous ancestor of the kings. So we need to give Judah a good backstory in that those early stories about the sons of Jacob. So we have that happening. But also the text, they're all coming together at the same time, and they have these same influences, and that if Deuteronomy is probably a little later than some of the that, but we have these three law codes that we see that are developing at different times and reflective of different interests. So the Deuteronomistic law code is very focused on the covenant. We have in Leviticus the priestly and the holiness code that are focused on like very priestly things, and so the context of what was needed in the law code, I think, is different, and that's influencing what is getting written. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but it's a follow-up.
Okay.
How about Herodotus? I mean, isn't it true that if David is the prototype for what we see in Kings, as you say,
right?
Herodotus is the prototype for the author who presents universal history. It was written after Herodotus.
I guess I don't think about it as so different. I think that when we look at the thing that appealed to me about the Book of Kings is that this is a major historiographical work. And so what is the job of a historian? It's not just to say this thing happened, this thing happened. It's to take the sources, take the oral histories, and create a narrative that makes sense as history by creating causal connections between each thing. So you mentioned that there must have been some kind of records, right? At the end of each king, it says, and the rest of the deeds of the king are written in the annals of the king of Judah, the king of Israel. So we don't have any of those, but presumably that means that somebody wrote a bunch of stuff down that happened during that king's reign, and it was in the library, or, you know, they boxed it up and they shipped it wherever. And I would be happy to say that this historian has access to those and he's reading those. But what a historian does that's different from just like an archivist is he's creating a story. So he takes all those events and he says why they happened. He makes a connection why this thing is separate from this. And certain things are more interesting to him and certain things are less interesting. And so he spends more time on those things. Ancient historians like the Deuteronomist or Herodotus were not beholden to the kind of self-awareness, attempt for objectivity that our modern historians are. They were fine to say, this is history as I see it. And that was their historiography.
Is there another question out there in the audience? Okay.
You talked about when Josiah, in the time of Josiah, found the book in the temple. I think if you were questioning that particular formation, what do you think was going on?
So this story of the finding of the book in the temple is often referred to by scholars as a pious fraud. There we have some other instances of a genre within ancient Near Eastern literature of this like found book. I guess it's not that important to me whether it was found or found. Because a story like this gives it legitimacy and authenticity. What is significant, I think, is that Josiah is really doing something very innovative. For the whole history of the religion of Israel, people were sacrificing everywhere. You read the story of the patriarchs, they have like some numinous experience and then they pile up some rocks and they sacrifice there. So that was okay. And so even in the time of the early temple, they were sacrificing all over. And so what Josiah tries to do, centralizing the cult into Jerusalem, was probably an uphill battle. So how are we going to get everybody on board with this? We're going to make our new thing not look new. We're going to give it sort of street cred with an ancient document that we found. We're going to go to the prophet and get the prophetess Huldah to tell us, like, yeah, this is a real book. And then we're going to make proclamations, oh, no, God is going to get us because we're not doing these things in this book we're supposed to be doing. So all of these things, like, he has, like, kind of an amazing PR machine that is setting up this situation in which his royal cult is going to be disseminated throughout the kingdom. This is the way you get people behind sort of a new radical thing by making it look not new. And so having a book, whether they found it or planted it or wrote it or the priest wrote it and gave it to him or whether he wrote it or he had it written, that to me doesn't really matter. But just having that story gives us sort of this authority to his reform.
It seems like Jeroboam is doomed to fail.
He was written that way.
I mean, so he said to him, we're going to make you a great king of this kingdom of Israel. and your children will follow you, but he couldn't deliver, he wasn't allowed to deliver because he couldn't get the cultic sites that were the correct ones.
So that was what was appealing to me about Jeroboam as a figure, because in Jeroboam's 9th century context, his sites would have been okay. It's only in the 7th century Deuteronomistic context that these are bad news. We can't have sites like that. So he is written to be the villain. And not only is he the bad guy, but we're going to set him up to say, you had every opportunity. You were primed to be the next David, but look what you did. And now you become the antithesis of David. And so this is the case of Jeroboam, which I think is so interesting, is that this is where the literary sensibilities of what the historian is trying to do really come into play. Right? Jeroboam is part of the history. He probably even had these shrines, right? The story of the golden calf is probably a polemic against his shrines. That the historian was trying to write history, even though it wasn't the most objective history, he was trying to write history. So he couldn't write Jeroboam out of the story. So how do I put him into my story so that he works for my goals? So I'm going to set him up as the villain. I'm going to set him up as the major fall, because we know from the history that Ahab was the worst of all kings. But Ahab does not figure as the model for bad kings of Israel, only Jeroboam. And so this is all part of the literary construction of the history. I think in Kings, the Deuteronomist uses the prophets in two ways. First, this idea of prophecy and fulfillment, that they're going to, the prophet prophesies something and it's going to come true, that this becomes an organizing framework for the history. And that's what we have. We say, oh, don't do all the bad stuff, or, you know, this bad stuff is going to happen to you, and then it comes true. We have at each moment, in each of these, so that's the first thing, as a framing strategy. The second part is, at each moment that we meet these big kings, there's also like a prophetic piece that goes along with them. So in Jeroboam, there's this major, the man of God from Judah comes and basically condemns the shrines and prophesies of the coming of Josiah one day to, you know, fix up Jeroboam's problems. We see that Josiah brings the found book to the prophetess Huldah to give it some kind of authority. And so the prophets are venerated. I think that there were probably some older prophetic texts that are among the sources that the Deuteronomist brings in. And I think that it also, as you mentioned, demonstrates that Moses is sort of in line. Moses is the Moses we see in Deuteronomy is a product of the Deuteronomist, that he is the hero. Josiah and Moses cut from the same cloth. The Passover of Josiah goes back to the days of Joshua, so that this is really a historical remembrance that is connecting all of these characters, and forget about all those bad judges and the bad kings who are sort of in the middle. But we have the bookends. Moses, he was the first good one. Josiah, he's the last good one. And like everybody in the middle was kind of just there, and you know, they weren't like either of these guys, so they were kind of bad.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming, and I want to thank Professor Joseph for coming. And I encourage you to race to the bathroom, because there's only a few copies there to get your own. Toda rabba, Shabbat.
Thank you.
And now I will take the holy recorder.